Hello, and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, where we pick one overrated movie and one underrated movie and discuss them. I'm Ryan Oliver, associate editor at GotchaMovies.com and host of the Gotcha Movies podcast.
Hi, this is Octavia Kozak. I'm basically on the internet, but you can find me at DVD Talk, Oregon Herald, The Playlist, and BayAspire.com.
I'm Eric McClanahan, host of the podcast Adjust Your Tracking, film editor for Oregon Arts Watch, and I also am a features writer for The Playlist.
All right, so today both films are Octay's picks. We have a Spielberg on Spielberg episode, actually. Yes. So two big budget sci-fi movies that he's done. One definitely an underappreciated masterpiece, and the other one a movie that made a lot of money but is questionable in its quality. So we're going to start with the overrated film, which is the 2005 remake of War of the Worlds. So, Octay, why did you pick War of the Worlds as an overrated?
Well, first off, last time we were talking about maybe doing, I was talking about maybe doing Minority Report as overrated, but that movie's pretty excellent, and I think it kind of was hyped up by me a lot because it came out right after AI. I was a huge fan of AI. I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan, and it was just like the idea of yet another kind of like dark science fiction film based on a Philip K. Dick story. You know, I think I was a little too hyped up, and it didn't meet my expectations perfectly. I was expecting like this perfect, amazing masterpiece follow-up to Artificial Intelligence, but it's a pretty excellent film. So I didn't want to pick that because I thought it was, you know, after a while we were just like, yeah, it's going to be like a really mild, overrated kind of thing. And then we were talking about War of the Worlds, and I think War of the Worlds is a pretty good example of that because it got pretty decent reviews, it made a lot of money, and I feel like, especially watching it today, this is the second time I watched it like in 10 years since it came out, and I think its biggest problem is it's a little bit overblown and it's like kind of tonally all over the place.
Yes, yes it is.
It doesn't, there are some kind of almost Roland Emmerich-like disaster moments in it, coupled with some truly horrifying moments of like how civilization can collapse in a situation like that that feels real, but then like coupled with this kind of, and there are some annoying characters and character choices in it that like kind of get on my nerves. So like I really like I was kind of whatever about it when it first came out, and I wasn't like 100% on like whether or not we should do this as a overrated, and I was just like, yeah, you know, I know that I knew that it was overrated, but watching it for a second time now, I was just like, I was kind of taken back at how like it just felt like a bunch of ideas that were thrown in, and everybody, like, you know, you have all these power players, Spielberg and Tom Cruise and the producers and the studio,
H.G. Wells adaptation,
like the studio, I'm sure, like threw in some stuff. Like, oh, you got to have these moments in there.
Right.
You can't just have it be like this. And then, like, it's just like a bunch of heads talking. And it looks like everybody got like a little snippet of what they were trying to do. But on the whole, it's kind of like this atonal, it's a little bit of a mess.
It really is. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was going to say, it's a great mess in that it's like, okay, Spielberg makes some really, like, I think subtle and fascinating choices, especially this movie. It came out in 2005, 4 years after the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
And so, like, as these alien invasions are happening, people are just, like, they're confused and kind of broken and, like, figuring out what to do. You see a lot of American flags hung up in this movie, and it's not in, like, an annoying, jingoistic Michael Bay way, but it's, like, in a very, like, somber way. But, like, Spielberg's smart choices are juxtaposed with really stupid decisions in the script. This movie's a fascinating exercise in convenient plotting,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
How convenient is that Tom Cruise has the only running car? How convenient that whatever they take down happens to be controlling this whole thing and then everything? Yeah, like, there's just so many moments of utter convenience, and, like, Tom Cruise, I think, is a big problem with this movie.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
The casting is a big
issue. He's really miscast.
He's really miscast.
Whereas, just to interject about Minority Report, I think he's very good in Minority Report.
Yes.
It's using what he brings as an actor very well, whereas War of the Worlds 3 years later feels like, could he not find someone that could better play the blue-collar type that this
There's no
is.
Balance
That's the
to his performance. That's
no,
the, like,
it's all
even
over
when
the place.
He leaves the shipyard and his boss is, like, ragging on him about something, he's all, like, smiley Tom Cruise, and I'm just like, I don't buy you
and then
as
it
this
cuts
character
to him,
already.
It cuts to him driving, like, a bat out of hell on, a, like, a regular street where it's, like, it kind of cues you into the
I think
all the
that's
weird
where,
tonal jumps that the movie has, where it's, like, why is this guy driving? Like, it's just an odd choice. You know what I mean? Like, these moments.
I think that's where, like, Cruise's agents or the studio kind of, like, butted in, where they're just like, oh, it's Tom Cruise. We have to have all
he has
these.
To drive a nice
like,
car
he has to be charismatic. Yeah, that's where the miscasting.
Yeah.
That's where the miscasting comes in, because if it was, you know, like, Tim Robbins has a small role. If that was Tim Robbins, that would have been, like, people would be like, okay, people can buy him as, and, like, he's not as huge of a star, so they can get away with kind of, like, presenting him as this kind of like deadbeat dad, working class everyman who's just like having trouble with his children, and of course it's a Spielberg film, so you're gonna have daddy issues in it as usual.
But they feel
you're
so have the broken family on in this movie. Like you know, his daughter, played by Dakota Fanning, does a pretty good job. She kind of annoys me as an actor. You know?
Even in 2005, when this movie came out,
she's
I was
a bit
like,
older.
Wow, she's really annoying.
Her thing is basically
she's grown
screen
into a better
time.
Actor, I think, or
she
making
has.
Better choices. And like as a child actor, you know, you can't really blame her. Somebody was telling her, "Hey, scream." At like pitches that dogs can hear, like really.
There are these scenes that are just like calibrated in really weird ways, where like you just referenced, like the Dakota Fanning like has these fits of like fear, and it just like gets shrill sometimes. Like this movie gets shrill at times, where it really seems like I get the point they're going for, like the loss of humanity so quickly, and like how freaky people can be. As opposed to the alien threat in this movie. It's like, I get what he's going for, but like, it never really works in the moment. Like, the execution of that stuff seems all over the place. But really, I guess we can get more to that. But like, to get back to the Tom Cruise thing, like, I think he's the big problem with this movie.
He is a huge problem. And it's weird because there are moments of levity that he gives this movie. But like, there's so few.
But they're the cool,
between.
Charismatic Tom Cruise kind of levity, where it's just like... He pops out of the crowd, and this is supposed to be like a film where
he gets lost.
You know, H.G. Wells adaptation. I don't know if you guys read the book, but the whole point of the H.G. Wells, like, it's kind of like the same thing. It's an alien invasion told through the perspective of a character who's just like so like not really special. Like it could be anyone that you could pick off a crowd, and it's like his basically. Attempts at survival. That's the whole thing. He just like goes from one person in one location to the next, and you know, I think the whole time it's just him. It's just this one guy,
right?
And that's kind of the point. And it's just like casting someone like Tom Cruise in that role, as opposed to like I could imagine John C. Reilly or you know, like someone
great
like
idea.
That, where it's just like
how better of a
could
movie
have sold
it would have
it.
Actually
yeah.
been.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they really needed Tom Cruise to sell this movie. I mean, it's a Spielberg mega blockbuster with, like, do you remember the money shots that they showed off in the trailer for this? Like, that, I think, is why people went and saw this movie.
And none of them had, like, Tom Cruise dead center in the frame.
Yeah, and I really think the movie would have been better with just a more appropriate actor in that role. I mean, hell, you even said it. Tim Robbins, who's
Tim
not
Robbins.
Great in his little sequence in this movie, but, like, would have been a better fit for that character.
It's because the writing and the tone and the you know, the pacing, like, really drags down the film during his scenes.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's his fault. I think
he
does a pretty good
job.
Because
the movie has a propulsiveness, and there are things I want to compliment this movie for.
Mm-hmm.
Is the effects
are
wonderful for the
they
most
still
part.
Hold up 10
still
years
hold
later.
Up.
Yeah.
And the propulsiveness, it's just under 2 hours. Like, I like that it doesn't feel bloated like some Spielberg movies can. Like, I love Minority Report, but that movie you could accuse of going on too long, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But this one for me is, you know that column on the Dissolve, Nathan Rabin writes it, called Forgot Busters?
Yeah, yeah.
Where he re-examines a movie that was a big hit in its
got
year.
Forgotten.
And basically loses, you know, doesn't really become a part, doesn't continue on in the pop culture.
Yeah.
War of the Worlds is like, I looked it up because I figured he'd already covered it. He hasn't. This is like the perfect example.
Because you bring it up now, nobody talks about
nobody
it.
Nobody talks
really
about
it.
I was at Suncoast today, and they have a huge 50% off clearance section.
Uh-huh.
I found like 8 copies of War of the Worlds there, and it's like $1.50.
Yeah, and you're like, oh yeah, that's right.
I saw that. Yeah.
And I'm glad, Ryan, you also brought up the idea that this is like, it's bathed in like 9/11 imagery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even evokes some imagery from New Orleans during the Hurricane
Katrina,
like the bodies floating in the river.
You feel the devastation of those scenes.
That stuff
is
very effective, but I also just think it's interesting to counter, because this is one of those years for Spielberg in 2005 where he did his blockbuster movie and then he did his serious awards movie in Munich. And they're both, 2005 was like the year of 9/11 for Spielberg. You know, like he deals with some of those themes in Minority Report before, but I think it really was this year, 2005, was like he was all about 9/11 and commenting on it. Those were the themes he was interested in. And for me, it's it's always interesting to see which movie is more interesting the year he does that sort of double take, you know? Mm-hmm.
Right.
And for me, Munich is by far the better, film.
And it's the last great movie.
Munich is,
done,
I would say, his last great movie.
I agree. And I think War of the Worlds is interesting to bring up in terms of like how it's more like the stuff that's followed after Munich, which I haven't liked at all very much.
No,
even his serious movies that people tend to like.
Like Lincoln and War Horse.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I don't like those movies much at all. And War of the Worlds, I'd actually would take over those.
I couldn't argue this movie being a fun movie, though.
No,
by any
that's
means.
The
it's a weird,
that's the problem.
Like,
that's what I mean by the tone. Because there's some moments in it where it's like the tripod is like breaking through the bridge, and you see like the Roland Emmerich moments, like the cars flying all over the place, and you're just like, whoa, that looks amazing. And then you have a moment that is just like, that's actually beautiful, where, I mean, beautiful in a really morbid way, where it shows you the brutality of what that kind of a genocide could result in, where one of my favorite scenes in it is where Dakota Fanning is by the lake, and you see all these like bodies floating by, and his dad just like grabs her, and that's like a really touching kind of harsh moment that would have really worked if you weren't thinking about like, wait, the couple of scenes before this like kind of telegraphed this idea that I was supposed to have fun with this movie, and now, and like those are my favorite scenes in the thing. Like my favorite of them all is probably when this burning train just passes by.
Yeah.
It's like
it's
a really short
moment. It's just a visual moment,
but it just like takes your breath away, because it just gives you like this idea of the devastation in this story, where it's supposed to be just told from like this family's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you find out, when it's like when you're down on the ground and you just like find out about like this happened and that happened. Someone says like, oh, New York is destroyed. You can't really tangibly, you get an idea of like the tragedy of that, but you can't really tangibly understand. But then you see something like an entire train passing by with like just burning corpses inside.
It makes the world
like
a little bigger.
And those moments are great, but then you have these like moments of levity, really dumb character choices, like pretty much everything with the sun.
The sun is really bad.
Just like really bugs.
Yeah. Maybe the most blatant of the sort of like 9/11 parables we're getting.
I'm going
to
become a soldier.
Yeah, he wants to go join the army. He's like, we have to get him.
And
we have
it just
to
happens like really out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Any sort of build up beyond the conflict he has with his father.
And then, spoiler alert, conveniently meets back up with
him
at the end, which is really
good. Let's get to the ending, because
I think we're going
to
do that.
I think we have to.
That's fine.
Because the ending, I will say, is Spielberg is notorious for his problematic endings, that where he just doesn't know either when to end it, or he makes these odd choices where he doesn't have the balls to like stick with something.
Right.
And War of the Worlds is one of his most egregious, I think.
Yes.
Like the ending really undoes a lot of any goodwill that the movie had, because it counters. It's another example of the odd tonal balance of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
if he's taken it seriously, if the movie's not so much a fun blockbuster, but like almost like a horror movie blockbuster, which is kind of what it feels like it's going for, it should be ballsier with the decisions he made at the end of the film, and it's just not. Like,
there's so many things wrong with the ending, and I want to first bring up the, you know, before we get to the son and how he like kind of pussies out of that. I want to talk about the aliens a little bit. I mean, the aliens are not as dumb as the aliens in Signs, because Signs is basically like, hey, let's go land on a planet that's 3/4
stuff that
water,
kills us.
stuff that like just kills us. Let's just go invade that planet instead of
rains?
What if it rains? We're all fucked. Hey guys, as long as we don't move to Portland or Seattle, we're gonna be fine.
We'll be fine.
But yeah, I mean, but they're still pretty, like, the thing about the H.G. Wells novel coming out of, I think, like late 19th century is that, you know, it was groundbreaking in science fiction at the time, and the ending at the time, I guess it made a little more sense, because it has the same exact ending. It's the aliens land, they wreak havoc, and they destroy, and then all of a sudden they all start dying because of viruses.
They were doomed from the beginning, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly. They
were
doomed.
They
can't handle the air. The whole thing was supposed to be like viruses. That's why, like, Independence Day has that shitty, clunky send-up to World of Worlds, where it's like it's a computer virus instead of like a organic virus. But that's the whole point of H.G. Wells' ending. And also, it was like around the time where it's like all these scientists and intellectuals were trying to like sell the idea of germs and vaccine, you know, hygiene and health and stuff like that. So it was a good way to have it in like a novel, to have like, oh, you know, germs can cure you or kill you.
Right.
And, but to stick with that ending for, I don't know what, like fan service or whatever, like in this kind of like modern narrative form, it really just comes out of nowhere. It just like feels like a cop-out to be like, oh, the aliens are all dead.
You know? Well, I mean, and that's not so much what bothers me as the let's just stick with the ending. We're in it. Let's just talk about it. Because, like, it's the fact that, you said it, spoiler, the sun survives in a way that seems completely impossible. Am I right?
An entire field these troops are fighting.
Goes up in flames.
Yeah, it's just totally incinerated.
It's one of those things where what we're being shown, and Spielberg is so good, and this film shows it off, his sense of scale and the way he frames things. Like, think of that boat sequence where it's tipped over. I mean, that is an incredible sequence, right? And he does it again on this hilltop sequence where the son and Tom Cruise finally get to their like last, like he's going to go and fight and Tom Cruise has to stay with Dakota Fanning and take care of his daughter. They have their last fight and he goes over that hill and it lights up and you see one of the tripods.
It's a very devastating looking scene, as we've talked about.
It's the equivalent of Return of the Jedi when they blow up that satellite. It's like, so certainly everybody within the vicinity of that satellite just...
And then you see Han Solo like 2 feet away from him.
It's that fake where it's like it goes against the sort of gritty reality he wants to portray in the
Yeah, it works in Return of the Jedi because it's Return of the Jedi. It's Star Wars.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And this movie, it's just it's another tonal inconsistency or it's an odd choice where it feels like with that son that Spielberg just didn't have the balls to be like, let him be a character. We don't know what happens. We figure he's dead, but if he never did anything...
That would have been totally fine.
Yeah, it would have been much better.
Yeah, because my experience when this movie came out was similar to yours, Octave. I kind of liked this movie when it came out. Yeah. And there were things that bothered me. And then I remember, even though liking it in the theaters when it came out, I hated the ending that the son survived. That was my big issue because I didn't mind the fact that that's how they were undone, the aliens, was by the virus. It was just that last epilogue thing that Spielberg is guilty of a lot of time.
Just have to do it.
Which will be interesting to talk about how good it works in AI, the film we're going to talk about next. Exactly. But I can't stand that he would have the sun survive.
It always has to have that buttoning moment. And
it rarely works out.
Thing about this, the way that it doesn't work, that's doubly frustrating because it practically, like you said, doesn't work. And it's also kind of a cop-out.
Exactly.
So even if it worked kind of practically, you'd be like, of course he's right. But then you have that whole scene where it's just like you get the scale of that one giant shot.
Exactly.
And it's like a napalm like dropped into that. There's no way that kid could have survived.
It's the beginning of Apocalypse Now.
Pretty much. That kid is dead. Yeah, exactly.
So
why didn't he, if that was like a later decision or during post or something, part of a reshoot, why didn't he reshot that scene or re-edit it in a way that would make it look like maybe he could have survived?
Yeah.
But the way that it's edited in the final product, it's just like, it really hits you on those two ends of like ridiculousness.
Yeah.
That, like, really like just bugs you. And the idea of, you know, you can understand, you can kind of appreciate, not that I like Roland Emmerich's films, but it's like when they have that big happy ending where everybody just hugs and kisses and the music soars.
Yeah.
You can be like, all right, it's a shitty, campy, like, B sci-fi alien invasion movie. Mm-hmm. But when you have a film where just like these alien ships and like tripods just like suck people and like just basically like spit out their blood, and
there's
just like
people,
you know, there's just like human blood and ash everywhere, and it's just like all over your face and body, and you have like these really horrific things happening.
Yeah.
After all of that, I don't really give a shit about seeing like your family reuniting with the music soaring and all
it's
that stuff.
It's not true. Like, it's a lack tonal, of truth. Yeah, you know, like it doesn't feel like it was earned, you know? Like it doesn't. The more appropriate choice would be to have a note of ambiguity or, we know the son died, and that's it. You know, it's like,
they should just treat the characters as vantage points instead of trying to flush them out or flush them out more.
Right.
It reminded me, actually watching it, was the newer Godzilla movie that came out. Where okay, this is technically impressive.
Yep.
And, like, I like this idea of humans as vantage points, but you're sticking me with characters who I could give a shit about at all. And that's how this movie kind of is.
And, you know, another thing I want to compliment War of the Worlds on is it was... Like, I feel like Cloverfield got a lot of credit 3 years later when it came out for giving you the sort of disaster pick that doesn't give you the cuts to the government or the president.
Yeah, yeah.
But War of the Worlds did that, like, you know, three
it did
years
pretty
before.
Well in that
like,
sense.
That's one of the things I did really latch onto when I first saw this movie and still appreciated when I rewatched
You're
it.
You're in the moment. Of
You're
this
in
movie.
The moment, and the fact that it's a everyman type of lead character and it stays with that vantage point and then it limits what you actually see in terms of effects is almost like an indie idea, like an indie indie movie type, yeah, where you have a limited budget, yeah, yeah, so you can't. I like that he uses that, but still has the budget to show you.
If
the
he had maybe
effects, you know,
maybe
but,
didn't if he didn't maybe cast Tom Cruise, maybe he would have gotten like a smaller budget instead of 150 million, maybe like 100 million. You yeah, know, like too bad for him, but whatever. But it would still have that kind of like amazing effects and amazing look. But it maybe would have had a bit more of that personal feel where it's like. Yeah. Another thing that bugs me about Tom Cruise's casting is like it's so obvious that they were just like, oh, we can't have him be like an everyman, so he has to be the one to like drop the grenade into the alien ship. Exactly. He has to be the one like where there's like all these trained soldiers everywhere who have been studying these creatures. And he has to be like the random guy, yeah, who just like points out the shields when everybody else is like, huh, what?
That
with the birds?
The hell,
you know,
out of
it's
yeah,
like,
you know, from the get go, like you said, they set it up to where like, okay, he's gonna save the day.
Yep.
Like you basically, he's like, you know, you, it's not a doubt in your mind that he doesn't know what he's doing
from the first scene.
You should
yeah,
know what he's
even
doing,
though the son is yelling at him that he doesn't know what to do. And it is one of those things where the actors are reading their lines and they're saying things that are supposed to tell us about the characters, but you never believe it because Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise. And I think the big problem with his casting is like, he's limit. Tom Cruise always gives 110%, right? We
yeah,
all
yeah,
can agree he works
right,
really
that's
hard,
true,
right?
That's true.
But he's limited by the quality of material. So you mm-hmm, give him a sort of bland, like you give him this role where he's a blue collar type. You just, it's for me, it's just not believable.
Yeah.
I see Tom Cruise, it doesn't work. Or in something like Valkyrie, I don't believe him as a fucking German officer. It's just stupid, you know.
Yeah,
it right, doesn't work. But you put him in the right role, and it tends to be a really good marriage. Edge of Tomorrow.
I was about to say most recently.
Yeah.
You buy him as a Weasley kind of PR guy who's
great,
afraid to be on the front line.
And it's a great play on the arc of Tom Cruise as the action hero.
Right, because
it's,
you know, in Mission
thing,
Impossible, as Ethan Hunt, you're like, yeah, he's going to fucking do this. Whereas he's like, mm-hmm, no, I don't do these things.
Yeah.
So you see him get killed repeatedly because
yeah,
he doesn't have that skill set. Yeah, that's why that movie is...
War of the
great,
Worlds feels
yeah,
very script noted. I think you're kind of
yeah,
alluding to that, Oxy, where it's like...
It's like there's
just,
a lot of talking heads saying,
yeah,
like, oh, we need to have
way,
this in there, we need to have that in there, and they just, like, all clashed with each other.
I find it fascinating when that happens in some of Spielberg's movies, because he's an auteur. He has a style that we can recognize.
Yeah.
This movie
like,
is Spielberg as fuck. It, to
oh,
the
yeah,
point
yeah,
at times where it's almost,
it's almost
self-parody.
Like a
self-parody.
Yeah,
self-parody.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, there's
the
a lot of vantage... Yeah, there's the reflections, there's the vantage points from Dakota Fanning's look,
Deadbeat
from
Dad,
the kid perspective.
The
yeah, there, yeah, there's,
look,
like, three shots that's, like, you know, planes or birds are flying,
exactly,
and she's looking. I was like, okay, this is getting... Or the aliens' periscope that comes down, very like Jurassic Park esque.
That whole sequence with at the Tim Robbins house, where the aliens keep coming back to investigate and look for them, is the raptor
yeah,
moment
it,
from
yeah,
the
yeah,
first
yeah,
Jurassic
exactly,
Park.
It is.
It
yeah,
does feel repetitive, even though in the moment it's still like suspenseful and works. But it's like mm-hmm, he's like a musician that with the next album just kind of redoes the same thing that worked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It,
yeah.
That's boring. And do you ever notice with Spielberg when he's kind of on autopilot, which I would say for the most
mm-hmm,
part in War of the Worlds, as
yeah,
technically efficient
yeah,
as this movie is, how when he's on autopilot, I would say another movie it's an example is The Lost World.
Yeah.
Remember
yeah,
he made
yeah,
that movie? Is... Do you ever notice he ups the Spielbergian, like, he,
yeah,
not
yeah,
only the Spielbergian tendencies, that's, it's like he's out of ideas or doesn't, he's not as invested
yeah,
in the
because when you get to that point
also,
where you're a little bit more lazy, you're just
right,
like, oh, I'll give him more of what they want.
But he,
first
but he also ups the stylistics. Like,
yeah, yeah,
War of the Worlds is incredibly stylish. Like, there's that long take scene where they're driving the minivan,
yeah,
escaping,
mm-hmm,
and it goes all as one take, and it's, you know, it was like cut together like Children of Men with like,
yeah, yeah,
you know, making it all look, or Birdman-esque, where it like makes it look like it's
mm-hmm,
one unified shot, and you know, well, wow, however they did that, it looks amazing, but then it's like, to what purpose does that really serve other than
yeah, yeah,
than
other than
being,
it looks cool.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Their dialogue's really bad.
It's just
in
an
that
expositional
sequence,
yeah,
yeah, it's
that
just an expositional
really
scene.
Bad.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's like
really
very
bad,
bland.
And it has those moments where Tom Cruise won't explain things because he's like, there's no time, but it's like, you can't just say aliens are
aliens
attacking.
Are attacking.
Like,
everybody's
what?
Dead.
Yeah, it just
yeah, exactly.
It's a strange movie, and I think I honestly will just call it Spielberg on autopilot because Lost World
pretty
makes
much,
me think
yeah,
the same thing. Where Lost World has like some amazing effects. There's these sequences where it's like he really ups the like long takes and things like that. And to me, that's usually the signal that Spielberg's kind of bored or not that invested mm-hmm. in the material. Mm-hmm. Because you watch Munich and that film just looks amazing. Like, it mm-hmm. looks yeah. Spielbergian. Janusz Kaminski's like using that bleached white light. That
every scene has a purpose in it.
In this era, it really does.
He challenges himself as far as like the material goes.
He does.
And how far he wants to go with it.
Munich has maybe falters one scene near the end, I'd say, but really consistently is his strongest work from this sort of dark period, I think.
Oh, definitely.
This dark area.
I'd say Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is another Spielberg on autopilot one.
I mean, that's worse than autopilot. That's like Spielberg on like
Lucas's
ambient.
Lucas's sleeping.
Yeah, that's true.
Sleepwalking. That's Spielberg sleepwalking.
Spielberg like shit. Aliens, really? All right, I'll do it.
That's Spielberg like pushing a button and just like taking a nap. That's not like it's not like autopilot where it's just like, oh, I'll just put this on cruise control or something like that. He's just like, all right, I'm just gonna take a nap. Like, let me know. Oh, cruise. Oh, fuck off. No, I didn't. That was totally unintentional. I'm not taking credit for that
one. I really think that it, this is one of those it's a movie that it makes sense that it's kind of lost any cultural relevancy and like people don't talk about it anymore and people really don't even talk about Munich unfortunately much and they should.
Munich is actually really good.
It's a great
maybe
film.
That should show up on another episode
exactly.
But it's weird, it's like in the context of Spielberg movies this is vastly overrated, especially since it made like $600 million worldwide, but it's like but compared to like some of the crap like Transformers or Independence Day,
I think
this is a much smarter movie than that. It's just frustrating that it isn't smart enough, I guess.
No, I'm just also, dude, it's lean. Like the under 2 hours compared to your Michael Bay spectacles, your Roland Emmerichs, which are always bloated,
getting close
to
3 hours.
Exactly.
At this point. Yeah.
There's a lot of things to compliment War of the Worlds on that sort of efficiency.
That's what makes it a little bit frustrating.
It does. It makes it more frustrating, and that's why I think it's a really great overrated pick, because I think people gave it a pass. I think I gave it a pass even though moments bugged me when I saw it the first time, because it did things differently in a way where I was like, I wish more blockbusters were made like this. Mm-hmm. I just wish this were also a better movie. In hindsight, it's kind of
I gave it a pass too. It's like, it's Spielberg. Of course it's great. It's
totally, man. Yeah. And I liked him going into this more dark era that he's been in. And I think it'll be worth talking about how AI really kind of signals the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love this dark era for him. And he's trying. But it's also the time where he does have this tonal problems where mm-hmm. It's never been something I think has been much of an issue for him, because he's either making very childlike films where kind of anything can go and you accept it, or serious, like almost prestige dramas.
But they're optimistic point of view, usually.
Exactly. And it's just strange, like Minority Report, as much as I do love that movie, has also these odd sort of tonal humor moments where it doesn't quite fit, where like he's getting his eyeball surgically removed and he has to chase it down a ramp like these weird sort of like slapstick moments where it doesn't fit, and it seems very odd.
Well, one of my issues with Minority Report is kind of that, is that it feels like a string of short films to me. Because every single, it's very episodic. It's like every place he goes to, you never meet that character again, it doesn't come up again. It's like, okay,
like
we deal with
Vice
the
in that way.
Kind
of.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really weird connection there.
They'll never be uttered in the same sentence.
That's kind of true, but I don't think it was as on purpose as Inherent Vice was.
I think
that was kind of like, because that's supposed to be creating a story that's supposed to be very intriguing and make sense, and like every single piece comes together. So it's like the exact opposite of the motivation for Inherent Vice to exist.
Exactly.
But yeah, it has that same kind of problem where it's just like, he just like packs in too much of that stuff. And I think that's where the biggest, my biggest issue with the Tim Robbins sequences, that's where they come in.
Let's
because
talk about that.
To me, it bugs me because the acting and the writing in it is like has some of the best moments in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, because it goes on for so long, mm-hmm. and it's such a like, it turns into like a weird like theater
piece.
Movie, like
yeah.
a chamber piece for like a good 20 minutes in the middle of this like giant blockbuster, which there's a part of me that said like, oh, it could be interesting to have a movie entirely like this.
It's a ballsy move.
It's
a ballsy move. It just
isn't really, not to mention an action that one of the characters has to take, which is ballsier than the ending, I would say.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't show you, but you know what's
happening.
Yeah.
And you know, there are some effective moments in that sequence, and I respect what he's going for. The ballsiness it takes to just remove this very propulsive, forward-moving thriller chase thing mm-hmm. and stop it dead. Mm-hmm. Like, just stop it dead and, like, a chamber piece almost happens. But my biggest issue is, like, the awkward moments that still arise where, like, Tom Cruise is trying to comfort his daughter, and yeah. like he can't think of the lullabies that she likes to sing.
So he sings like a rock song.
He sings "My Little Deuce Coupe," and it's like, honestly, I remember not liking that moment and kind of just letting it go when I first saw mm-hmm. it. But it really appeared to me as a glaring, like, just really misstep. Like mm-hmm. to me, it's one of those scenes where, even as someone who isn't a filmmaker, I'm like, why is that in the movie? Cut that scene right out of there, because there's a better way to portray him becoming a better father to her than yeah. that. It just felt. I just don't like the way it's executed.
It's like a lazy paint by numbers kind of, like, okay, we have this like cute little song scene to like bond them.
It's Tom Cruise-y in a way that doesn't work for this fucking character. He's like,
that goes back to the casting.
He gives her a look when she's like, what song are you singing? And it's supposed to be cutesy and funny, and it's just like, it's all wrong for the moment.
Yeah.
I was kind of slapped my forehead during that moment watching it last night. So yeah.
And then, like you said, there's like the repetition of the raptor scene, which like goes on uh-huh. with the tension. You know, the tension is fine, but then, you know, like if you start thinking about like, oh, he did it better in these other movies,
mm-hmm. you're then already lost.
Yeah, and it's, but yeah, there are those moments where it's just like, it would have been, maybe would have been amazing if the movie ended where, you know, after the choice that Tom Cruise has to make,
right?
And, you know, because that's a big deal at that moment, and it's just kind of like right after that you have another big action set piece,
right,
where he like saves the day, and that's supposed to like make up for what just happened.
Yeah,
and I don't think they even like consciously thought about like, okay, what's gonna, how are we gonna like morally make up morally for what he's done. I think they were just like, they just like glossed over what he did and turned him into an action hero immediately.
It's a very dark, interesting move in the movie.
That's true.
Yeah, it really does.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah,
you're right.
I didn't
either. And apparently the movie didn't either, because then I just glazed over
it. You forget all about it in a way. And I will say, as much as I didn't have too much of an issue with the way the aliens are, you know, defeated, or they kind of get defeated by, you know, just the nature of what they're breathing when they come to our planet, I didn't mind that so much, even though it kind of doesn't fit when, like, Morgan Freeman just starts to narrate in the beginning and ending.
That was the beginning of that Morgan Freeman narration.
Yeah.
That's why, like, it bugged me so much to hear his voice, but then I had to remember that, oh, it's 2005. Okay, it's not as... If this was today and Spielberg made that decision, I'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah,
seriously.
Really? At this point?
Like, Conan the Barbarian used the Morgan Freeman narration. Like, just give it up.
But, as much as that doesn't feel right either, and it's a problem, another problem in the ending is, I don't mind so much the aliens, the way they're, you know, that it's faithful to the book. It's that it does, it can't help but feel anticlimactic in the mm-hmm. movie, in the mm-hmm. moment, because it just sort of stops dead, and they go to Boston, and the movie's just like done now all of a sudden. And it, in a weird way, as big budget as the movie is, it makes it feel like they ran out of money, and they kind of had to like wrap it up all of a sudden.
Yeah. That's so what it kind of feels
the
like.
The movie is for me, like an interesting failure, or an interesting attempt at making something a little more serious in this golden age of, well, I wouldn't call it golden age, but like the machinery of the blockbuster era that we're in, right?
Yeah,
like it stands out, and it does some things right, and you want to support it,
but it just makes too many left turns, like too many right turns, I guess.
Yeah,
too many
right turns.
Yeah, too many right
left
turns
would have been interesting, right?
Right,
we needed some left.
It
turns.
Did need some, but it just makes the turns
it becomes
that
too
you
convenient.
It, to make.
Yeah.
It does so in a frustrating way, and I think it's understandable that it's kind of lost its any relevancy in the culture, and it's kind of like it. I think anybody that would revisit it will probably agree, like, what did people like about this movie fully enough or give a pass for it, you know,
or
like back
to
then.
Make it make so much money.
A
too.
Lot of money. I mean, that's the machine we're talking
it
about.
It is the machine.
You know?
And I had to remember, too, this came before the whole couch jumping incident. This came before.
It was when the
right
movie was
before.
Coming out.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
He was promoting World War.
Oh, was
it?
Yeah.
It was
oh,
the promotion.
Okay.
Yeah, because it was Spielberg was supposed to be at Oprah, to come with him at Oprah, and they were supposed to be just talking about the film. And I think Spielberg got sick or something, and it was just Tom Cruise, and that's what led to. That's why some people say like, oh, if only Spielberg could make it to that interview, they wouldn't turn into that disaster.
Right, because this is probably his last really big hit besides the last two Mission Impossible movies.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's really struggled since to convince the audience that.
Despite giving some interesting performances,
absolutely.
I mean, say what you will about Rock of Ages, that's a more interesting performance than this. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I mean, the movie's a piece of shit,
but
I would agree with that.
But he's pretty fascinating in it.
Yeah, he's good at it. I would definitely say, like, I feel comfortable saying that this is one of his weakest performances, and just he's not done any favors. He should have never been cast in the role.
Yeah. No, it's because he does vain douchebags really well. That's why his best performance still is Magnolia, because of that. Collateral
is a very good role for him too. Absolutely,
and that's why this casting doesn't work, because he's not supposed to be that kind of either charismatic or the vain or whatever. He's supposed to be like the everyman. And like I said, just remake it with a little less money and put John C. Reilly in that role.
I like it. That's a better movie already, man.
Half the problems of this movie would be solved if just Tom Cruise wasn't in it. Sad to say, like him, but just not right for it. So, shall we move on to the underrated pick?
Let's get positive. Right.
Yeah, let's get positive. So, AI, artificial intelligence. Octave, this is probably the reason you created the show, I would say. So that's why it took me
a big moment. It took me a long time to actually settle in on our AI and finally get to a point where just like, all right, I'm kind of ready to like make this happen at this point. But yeah, AI is definitely like, you know, we're talking about the 2001 Steven Spielberg AI that Kubrick developed for decades before basically handing it off to Spielberg. Some people believe that... That is because after Kubrick's death, that Spielberg kind of like posthumously taken over. But there are people that don't really understand. You have to like really look into the history of the project to really understand that even if Kubrick was alive and kicking, this was probably going to be the movie that you were going to end up with anyway.
Yeah.
So, Kubrick was alive, he would have never had this happen or had that happen. But be like, this thing was pretty much set in stone, including the ending that people say Spielberg just tacked on there,
which is bullshit.
That was entirely Kubrick.
Yep.
And we're going to, you know, of course, we're going to talk about, like, why that's actually a Kubrick ending instead of a, you know, Spielberg ending.
Let's dispel those kind of bullshit assumptions that people have about this movie.
So this was, like, you know, a handful of the movies that I was always thinking about that I want to bring up. You know, first, when it first came out, I absolutely adored it. And, thought it was just this, like, the perfect, like, stepping into the 21st century, kind of like the first 21st century movie masterpiece that I felt like, because thematically and the way it handles its themes and how it's, like, it just felt way ahead of its time. And it's been, like, over the last 14 years, it's been proven, like, more and more that how ahead of its time it really is.
It's aged very well.
It's aged really, really well. And it's going to age better and better as, like, artificial intelligence technology gets better and better.
Right.
And and after that, I was just, like, really kind of surprised at how many people complained about this movie, how many people were just like, oh, this is terrible. And it's like, if only... Because it's like Kubrick fans said, if only Spielberg hadn't touched it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's too schmaltzy. And then the Spielberg fans said, like, it's too dark. It's too weird. It's too offbeat. Like, it has all these, like, Spielberg elements of, like, the little, you know, lovable little kid and the special effects and the kind of... It's like has those, like, E.T. elements and stuff like that in it. But it goes to these, like, really dark and really kind of just existentialist places and existentially kind of dark places as well,
right.
The stuff that you it makes you think about, like, the ending of humanity, for God's sake, like,
it
actually, like, shows you that. So it's like all that stuff, and like it just, like, drove me to like 5-6 years straight of just, like, going into the same exact conversations of, like, defending AI over and over again. I'm trying to explain to people, like, you know, the main points of, like, no, they're not aliens, they're super robots,
they're
taking over the world.
Yeah, that happened to me when I saw this movie. People thought it was aliens.
That just bugs me so much. Yeah. Like, have you been paying attention? And anyway, that happened so many times that, like, a couple years ago, I wrote this whole, like, essay on, like, a blog post, like, talking about, like, okay, these are the points why, like, this movie is great, and why people have, like, completely misunderstood it. But I feel like it's dated and it's aged extremely well. Mm-hmm. It's probably the last, like, you know, if we don't count Munich, it's probably the last, like, great masterpiece that Spielberg has done. Mm. And it's, I don't know, the way that it deals with humanity through artificiality, which is what Kubrick did with 2001 as well, and takes it to that next level, where, like, you're almost watching a movie entirely about HAL 9000, and he has a personality beyond, like, just servitude.
Right.
And it just deals with all these like questions about like if you have a machine that loves you, like what kind of responsibility do you have to love it back, and
right.
what, and if you don't love it back, what happens to it, and like if it's that's its whole purpose. So it has all these like really weird, interesting elements that makes it a great movie. So I want to like leave it up to you guys. Like, what'd you think about it? Did you watch it again? Since because we watched it like really
I didn't get
recently.
To watch it again, but yeah, you introduced it to me for the first time in like October, so
yeah,
still
yeah.
very very
it's
fresh.
Been, yeah.
You did not see it.
When I did not see it when it came
okay.
out.
Okay.
So watching it now, yeah, I would have thought it was filmed today. Like
cool.
visually, I thought it held up really well. That Blu-ray you showed me is just like
mm-hmm.
really really incredible. And yeah, it's much more darker than most Spielberg films up mm-hmm. until that point. I was very surprised at the places it goes. The like sort of, I mean, even though it's a robot, you still gotta remember this is a kid too, like
yeah.
this kid who's like lost in the wilderness just looking for his mom essentially
mm-hmm.
having to be in like a battle bot type arena at one point too
mm-hmm.
is like it's just it's yeah it's a very that's a great film that's all I, that's what
would
I
you
say.
Would you call it one of Spielberg's masterpieces if you think he's ever made one at all or
oh I mean I think he has it? I would say Jaws, Schindler's
Attaboy.
List are masterpieces. my favorites are Close Encounters and E.T. I would
right.
say they're masterpieces too.
Yeah
yeah I'd put this
no arguments
there, definitely
yeah.
See for me I really like AI but for me it's and this is just almost nitpicky, but I like Spielberg and I follow him, but this isn't a masterpiece for me. And to me, I actually think AI is guilty of some of the odd tonal shifts that we mm. just ripped War of the Worlds for, to be honest. And it followed through in Minority Report and then onwards to things like War of the Worlds. As good as this movie is, and I will say it's probably in Spielberg's filmography, it works best because it gets better as it goes. Like,
mm-hmm.
most of his movies get worse
yeah,
as they go.
Right, true.
Or end really, they falter in the ending. This movie has an amazing ending.
This sticks the landing probably better
oh my
than
God, it,
any
it,
of his movies.
It, he has, he's allowed to have a sort of Kubrickian formal, like, audacity of jumping ahead thousands of years in chronology, and it works so well for this
it's,
film.
It's a very ballsy project because they gave him kind of carte blanche to be like, okay, you have to honor Kubrick's memory now.
Yeah.
And nobody, I think, I don't think anybody, it looks
the
like nobody.
That
yeah.
I feel like he was
yeah.
friends with Kubrick. Like, you can
yeah,
tell
yeah.
it in interviews during the film.
And Kubrick
you know?
wanted Spielberg to direct it
yep.
because he thought the story, the way, the kind of compassion that Kubrick knew that he would need to give to this, like, robot boy character.
Yeah.
It was, like, more in tune with, like, Spielberg's sensibilities. And I
yep.
felt that, if he was to become a producer on the project or something like that, like then he would be able to like keep his kind of personality afloat as well. And that's
mm.
kind of what happened. And in a way it might have happened even better than that it was produced after he died, because
yeah.
there's that whole element of like, okay, because Spielberg and Kubrick worked on this project on and off for so long.
For a long time.
That's
yeah.
why he has screenplay credit. That's why Spielberg has a screenplay
the
credit.
The only other movie he's done that for.
Close Encounters. Yeah. Maybe he should write more often.
Yeah.
That's my, one
because
of
it has
favorites.
A really good,
I will
so,
say
yeah. it has a really good script.
Scripts
yeah.
are good in both of those, yeah.
yeah.
And he apparently is very involved with all the scripts that he films, but
oh,
like,
yeah.
he's never given credit, really, you know, and yeah, it's interesting that this
oh,
is
yeah.
one of those.
The scripts go through so many changes before they go to
definitely.
Production, so yeah.
Guy in
yeah.
his position.
But to have
sense.
A sole screenwriting credit
it's rare
with this
him.
And Close Encounters, it's crazy.
Because he did that because he worked on this on and off for so long that he didn't, after Kubrick died, he didn't want to transfer all that information, like
yeah.
decades worth of
why
stuff onto someone
another,
else
yeah.
that he wanted to just sit down and like that. That's where like that whole I like he wants to make good by Kubrick, and he wants to, you know, honor Kubrick's memory while also kind of making his own thing. And it's just like
yeah.
I think really appreciating this film, really, like, you have to be in that perfect kind of place where I feel like I am as a Spielberg fan and as a Kubrick fan.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Where there are elements in both Spielberg and Kubrick that I adore, and there are some elements where I find to be a little bit problematic. And
yeah,
to me,
yeah.
AI represented that like perfect melding of like, it has humanity, it has soul, it has compassion, but at the same time, it's just courageous
it's
with the, it's unflinching
it's
and
exactly
it's courageous with the themes of like love and artificiality and humanity. What makes us human? Is it just biology? Is it something else?
Right.
And what happens at the end, at all of it kind of like comes together. And first of all, like if you think that last 20 minutes, if you think those creatures are aliens, the whole movie is completely lost on you.
It's totally lost. You tuned out a long time ago at that moment. Yeah, I realized that with friends when I went to see this in the theater, that friends of mine that came with me were like, why were there aliens at the end? What was that all about? And I just was like, you guys tuned out a long time ago. Yeah. You know, it was very frustrating that they just weren't in, you know, they were not in lockstep with the movie, I guess, at all.
But even if you don't love it as much, I totally agree with you on the idea that it's a, this is definitely a builder.
Yeah.
In terms of like quality and in terms of like storytelling as well, because it starts off, and that's what I really love about it. It has that Kubrickian quality of like, you know, a lot of his films, 2001, Full Metal Jacket, have, like, work on these, like, little sections.
Yes.
Like, they have these little sections. Like, Full Metal Jacket has the camp, the training.
It's a film of two halves.
And then Vietnam, and then you have the sniper ending. Right. Where it's, like, it's almost like... And AI has that same kind of structure, where it's just, like...
It does.
It's little sections that build upon the theme and builds upon the story so well. And it just starts off being... starts off looking familiar and contemporary. You have this family setting, you have this robot child who's just like basically there to be, it's right from the start the robot child is there to still serve the human masters, but serve them in a way that's just not just practical, in a way that to fill this like
void.
Feel this like feeling of, because the whole point is that their son is in this like cryogenic thing. And at the beginning, you hear the doctor say, like, you know, you should just give up on your son. He's gone. And that's when it just, like, kind of, you know, it goes into, like you should start grieving. But because of, like, the science that we have available to us, we're still keeping your son alive. So there's still that, like, emptiness that would have probably been gone through, would probably go away through the grieving process if the son had actually died.
Right, exactly.
But it's still there, and it's just like eating these people alive. That's why, like, they get that robot, and the whole point of the robot is to serve this, like, emptiness within of these, this woman, and, you know, of course, the whole thing with Spielberg with his, like, father issues comes back again, because it's all about the mother. It's the mother who does, you know, it's not an accident that the mother is the one who does the imprinting process that starts that, like, fills in, like, the programming inside David, the robot boy, of, like, this, you know, it's just, like, this gorgeous sequence where, and Haley Joel Osment is, like, fucking rock star in this.
His
performance is amazing. Like, you see...
He doesn't blink.
He doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't blink the whole. Like, there's always
that would,
like,
be really difficult to do.
Yeah,
he's very accomplished,
especially for
actor.
Like a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah, and coming off of The Sixth Sense, like, he had two amazing roles as a child actor for sure.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you guys think, because, like, I already alluded to the fact that I find some tonal, like, problems in the movie, like, jarring. And for me, the flesh fair sequence when David has been thrown out, you know, his mom, his mother leaves him because their son is back alive, and now it creates problems, so they get rid of David. David goes off into this sort of Wizard of Oz-esque, like, adventure, you know, like, the world really opens up. The movie gets interesting.
And of course, there's the Pinocchio fairy tale element to it.
Exactly,
well.
Right, which is used very well in this movie, yeah. But, like, for me, there's executional problems where, like, the flesh fair, to me, it's the only point in the movie where I do feel like, God, I wish Kubrick would have made that moment. Because I feel like I couldn't help but...
Would have made it darker.
I just think there's these weird choices where, like, the flesh fair is where they're there to destroy robots, right? It's an awesome idea that, like, oh, humanity's got to this point where it's like a civil war is brewing between, you know, AI, Mecha, and Orga. What do they call it? Like,
Mecha and Orga,
yeah. I love that idea. It's a great idea, but the execution is just all off. Like, Kubrick, I'm sorry, wouldn't have had Chris Rock voice a black robot
Those little
and have him make
a
little
bit
weird
annoying,
like, gag line and then get blown up. Like, what was that doing in this movie? That's
true.
It's only a few moments in this movie, but it takes me out of it in a way where it's like, it's just a little falter. It's just a little thing where it's why I can't call it, it's why I can't call it, like, one of his masterpieces. But man, this movie is very, very strong because that's, it's just a few little nitpicks like that for me. But that flesh fair sequence really stands out.
Yeah.
Like it should be an amazing, memorable sequence. And to me, I'm like, it's like this weird comic booky thing where it's like, get that out of, like, move on or something. I don't know.
It doesn't really stood out to me.
Does
like,
it?
It just doesn't work for me.
That sequence.
Yeah, I still love it.
Yeah, I still think it works really well. But I actually forgot about the Chris Rock it's gag, not, but
yeah, this is a very weird
that
decision.
Bugs me too.
Why? It's Chris Rock. It's very strange.
There's little nitpicky moments like that that I can totally understand that like kind of bugs me too. Like the weird little everything that surrounds the Flesh Fair. Yeah. There's some like really fascinating stuff like visually. I love this like Brandon Gleeson's like the head of this whole organization with the Flesh Fair.
Yeah.
And I love that how he like pops up in this like giant.
Moon balloon,
and like it just turns into
an amazing image,
full on like fairy tale in that moment. Like, there's nothing practical about having that kind of a balloon in that situation.
Exactly, like, that looks like the moon.
Yeah,
than to reference famous E.T. iconography and twist it in a dark way, much more interestingly than he did with War of the Worlds. He wasn't retreading; he was just sort of like playing off of his.
Yeah, there,
what he's known for.
There are definitely like those like little nitpicky moments here and there in the Flesh Fair, and also with the kind of like red light district area that they go to. I can't believe that I can't even like remember the name right now because I've seen this movie like
Rouge City.
Yeah. Rouge City and Flesh Fair definitely has like a couple of nitpicky moments that are just like a little bit annoying, and one of them is actually not to me is Robin Williams' voiceover in that Dr. No thing.
I agree. That bugged me the first time I saw this movie. Now seeing it, it actually feels very appropriate that like he's like they go there and it's like essentially a Google search. Mm-hmm. Like that's just all they're doing, and you have to ask the question in the right way. Or, you know, assert your statement. And I liked the way that worked. And with the Robin Williams, felt odd at first, but fit a lot better. I don't even know exactly why.
And also,
it seemed to work much better.
Maybe it works much better because it's a little bit of trivia. It's the only scene that Kubrick directed. Robin Williams voiceover.
Interesting. Okay.
He, for some fucking reason, Kubrick invited Robin Williams to his place and had him record the dialogue for that scene.
Weird. I had no idea.
That's really strange.
So, it's the only thing in AI, the Robin Williams voiceover work Kubrick actually directed.
That's super cool. And I think that gets at to what you were ultimately saying and what we should get more towards, because like I don't want to sound like I have that many issues with this movie, because I don't. I think it's such a it's a very good movie. It's like one of his best, like especially of the last 15 years. It's up there. And like I said, it gets better as it goes, but like I totally lost my place.
The other bit of humor that I liked, I didn't think it was like really out of place, is Jude Law's character. He's like, you know, that he can do whatever the client wants him to do, essentially. Do you want me to do that? And he could just turn on a button, literally, and do it. And I thought a lot of good humor derived from that wasn't like out of place whatsoever.
Because it wasn't that like lame kind of, oh, it's a robot, so we have to make him like emotionless. It's like he's programmed for one certain thing, and that's all he knows how to do.
Right.
And it gives us like great juxtaposition of between David, because David is like a much higher level of programming where he has feelings, but at the same time he is also programmed to do this one thing, which is to love.
Yeah.
That's all he wants. And in a way, because he's a machine, he doesn't truly know why he wants the love of his parents, why he wants the love of his, you know, quote unquote mother. But then at the same time, that goes into like all these like really deep questions that the film kind of puts out there, which is basically like, do any of us really know that?
Right.
And do any of us really know beyond any kind of like biological kind of programming that we have, in a way to like really articulate why we love this person, or why we seek like love from this person, or why we hate that person? Like, it's just like all that stuff goes in. And the thing that really works, the levity of Gigolo Joe, I think, is that from the get-go, you know he's programmed to only please women.
Right.
So that's why it's so funny when you know, the whole thing about Pinocchio, that David hears about Pinocchio, so he wants to be a real boy. And the way that in the story, Pinocchio becomes a real boy through the blue fairy.
Right.
And as soon as he hears about the blue fairy, she's like, oh, it's a woman I can please. So he goes into that, like, sex place. He's like, oh, I'm going to make her moan, you know? It's like that kind of stuff. But it's like, it's funny because it's just like, it doesn't come out of, like, you understand why he has that kind of reaction. You understand why he's doing that. It fits within that character.
Exactly.
And the same exact thing with Teddy. You know, Teddy is
I love Teddy as a
Teddy is great.
Such an amazing
as like the Jiminy Cricket kind of character, where it's just like
he's always there. He's just there always.
Yeah,
I love that.
That's his thing. It's like this perfect like little tiny super toy that is almost like he's just there to like just take care of his master in any way that he can.
And he rides that perfect line of being like cuddly but actually more creepy than anything
else. Oh, absolutely.
It's a really well
realized. When I went up to the EMP in Seattle, their film museum,
they have Teddy there.
Nice. Yeah, so, I was very stoked to see that. It was like right after we watched it too. I was oh, that's so great.
Very nice. Yeah, do you guys, you've talked about it already, Octa, how like this movie was like a long in the works thing for Kubrick. Like, I remember reading about this movie that it wasn't even called AI at the time, but like that he had been working on it since the early 90s. And basically it was one of those where he was waiting for special effects to catch up and to realize the world he wanted to, like the polar ice caps melting. So like cities are just gone, and just to realize that on film. And I remember being teased about this movie for so long. And the other one was Francis Coppola always wanted to make some big, like post-apocalyptic science fiction film, like Megalopolis or something like that. And I just think the big thing I want to compliment AI is that it's like we got this movie. We never got that Francis Coppola film. And it's really what AI is this rare occurrence of like a movie nerd's dream, where it's like it is this perfect marriage between two very good filmmakers, albeit very different filmmakers. It's like this very unique thing where it's these kind of things don't happen very often. It's like a very cool, like rare occurrence, this movie. And I love that it represents that, but also like it's undeniable how well this movie's aged and like its ideas and how they play into the more technology continues to grow and speed up. Like,
yeah, because when it came out, we didn't have like Siri and we didn't have like all this amazing kind of interactive technology.
Could you have a movie like Her without AI? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe Spike Jones doesn't, those ideas aren't percolating. You know what I mean? Like, it's so far ahead of it, and Her.
I almost look at AI as like a pre. I almost look at Her as like a prequel to AI.
To AI, yeah. It's like a very prequel to that
same technology. Yeah, yeah.
You really could, and you really could. And yet, you know, when each one was released, like you can't get Her without AI. Like it's very. I like the way that, and appropriately for a sort of semi Kubrick project, like this one was not embraced on its original release. Yeah. And it had a decent opening weekend and had one of those, like, it really faltered after that because people thought it was too weird or whatever, like, the issues you brought up.
So even though it's like, you know, legitimately a Spielberg film,
right,
it had the same kind of reaction that Kubrick's film always get. It always takes, it's the exact same thing. It always takes 10 to 20 years down the line for people to start calling it a masterpiece.
Yes.
People start appreciating, people start revisiting it over, and just, like, it ages, like, perfectly. And you know, it had the same kind of, like, Kubrick reaction going on. And that's why, like, when it first came out, I knew that with all this, like, dissenters and people complaining about the ending and stuff like that, I was just like, you know what, just give it a little bit of time. People will come around to it. And that's pretty much kind of what happened. Like, a lot of critics who kind of gave it maybe a pass or just, like, criticized it. Like, Roger Ebert gave it kind of, like, a lukewarm review when it came out. And then later on,
he's since made it like one of his great
movies. And then later on, it became one of his great movies. Yeah. Of like, he said it's one of the greatest movies of the decade. Yeah. He's completely did like almost kind of a 180. Like, he kind of liked the movie anyway, but he had major issues with the ending.
Right.
And watching it again, you know, reading his original review, he refers to those creatures as aliens.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, there's your problem
right off the bat.
Yeah.
Better than that.
Exactly. Yeah. He basically writes like, oh, we don't know what they are. They might be aliens. They might be robots.
But it's very clear.
It's incredibly clear.
Yeah. They say it.
And Gigolo Joe says it. And that's why that one little scene in the, right after he runs out of Dr. No's office.
Yeah.
And he says that they made, that's, you know, there's this like one monologue. It's like they made us too fast, too quick, and too efficient.
Yep,
too and now many, they're afraid because we're going to take over.
And that's what
that's what's going to happen. And but even like it's like that, spelled out to the audience. That's what happened.
I think it's really interesting with that ending, with that, you know, it, like that leap forward in time, you know, and like visually when it suddenly like dissolves and you've got like a frozen landscape and you're seeing this amazing spaceship. Like, I love that shot, you know, the long shot of the spaceship flying. I love the way it's
realized.
Balls
that it takes to have a narration that says, and 2,000 years later.
To be honest, I mean, it's appropriate. It's a Kubrick thing because he did that. 2001 is rife with those sort of, you know, long leaps in time between cuts. It's it's exciting, and it really works well with Spielberg's, you know, his tendencies as well. It's fascinating to see that, and this is a film that I think is going to continue to really, you know,
age further. It's better down the line.
More people will see it. They'll come around to it. I wonder why. At the time, it was so hard for people to understand what the ending was going for, because on the surface, you might take it as, oh, it's all sentimental and happy and, like, isn't it great? But it's like...
It's actually pretty dark.
Let's actually talk about how dark... It's because they're creating a facsimile of what he wants, and he only gets it once.
Mm-hmm.
The whole notion of the ending, that his mother can be recreated from this lock of hair that he has,
which is bullshit. Like that their whole reasoning. Like there's more. Right. Like, there's underlying things happening there. It's not as.
Because why would the robot exactly?
It's not as easy as just like, you know, what they tell him is bullshit. Because first of all, okay, you know, you think they're aliens. The whole argument is lost.
Right.
And, like, the whole thing is lost from the beginning. And
they're an advanced.
They're advanced mechas. Robot, yeah. Human beings are gone. Basically, what they're doing is like those. Super mech. There's advanced mechas you see at the beginning. They're basically like paleontologists.
Yeah, they're scavenging
They're digging into the past. They're trying to learn as much about like humans as possible. And they find this one specimen that's incredibly important. Imagine digging up, you know, like a Jurassic Park type situation, like digging up like the DNA of a dinosaur and, you know, making it and then having this like specimen that can like directly link you. To the history that you're directly like, but the difference between that is that we as humans don't think dinosaurs made us. We as humans don't look at dinosaurs as like but mechas, those advanced mechas, know that the human beings were the ones that created them. It's like they're gods,
right?
And that's why like there's this one little scene. That kind of like, if you don't follow the thematic through line of the film, that kind of sticks out, where Gigolo Joe says, you know, he sees they're in front of a church.
Mm.
And he says that people go in there like to those who made us look for the one that made them.
Right.
And so it's just like, it completely links into that like idea of like looking for your God.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to like figure out humans, and they have this one specimen. And what happens, I think, is that, you know, you have that scene where they're reading his mind.
Right.
And everybody's, like, getting images of, like, his past.
Right.
Like, they're downloading his experiences. And they know that his entire life's goal was to find the blue fairy so he could turn into a real boy.
Right.
And they want to, I think, you know, first of all, he wakes up in this, like, perfect recreation of his old house.
Right.
Which I think it's completely... artificial.
Yep.
It's complete virtual reality.
Absolutely.
Artificial.
That's the way
it
reads,
it doesn't really exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way that like you see like the it goes to daylight to nighttime, like like they have you can tell immediately the way that they're like observing it that they have complete control in over his, like, it's either like a like mental like programming construct, or it's like, you know, they just like built it in a way that's like, it's like a zoo,
it's
basically.
Very similar to 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah,
Bowman goes through
the hotel room.
That is what the aliens, who we never see, that is something, it seems, that they have constructed. It's a zoo, an observatory.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we do for animals in a zoo, they give you the comforts, the things that a person would be used to. So they do that. And it's very similar to that, what the mechas are doing to David in that scene. Yeah, I'm with you. It's this constructed thing that they want to give him so they can learn from him, right? Like, he's this history that they can actually, like you said,
so he becomes
download
a specimen.
His experiences. Yeah,
so that's as far away from that kind of like Spielberg sentimentality as you can get.
Well, again, it's people looking at the surface of things, because on the surface he's getting his wish, but it's like, but actually think about the undercurrent of
what's going on, right?
Which, this being a Spielberg movie, it's more subtle than most of his. They do spell that out. I mean, the robots basically explain, even if it's total bullshit, that his mother can't live for more than a day. It's just this conceit that they've built
in. They tell him, this, like, you can have it.
They tell it to
him. It's only one day.
They leave it as a choice. And it's, all that stuff is very interesting. It's very spelled out. But I wonder if it's just the problem with people thinking it was aliens is just they were tuned out of the movie in the beginning. Sometimes movies are ahead of the audience, and I think
or people knowing
AI
that it's a Spielberg film, then people thinking, like, it's a typical Spielberg ending or whatever.
And I think if we're doing anything,
or people are used to, you know, Spielberg isn't always the most subtle filmmaker,
no,
so he can hold your hand through the ending of a movie. which you talked about with War of the Worlds. Right, some of his endings are problematic. This movie doesn't do that. No. There's no hand-holding to it. So people are like, what? You let go. Like, I don't know. I don't know where I am, what's going on.
There's like 2,000 years in the future. There's no people left. It's weird, so cool.
Like, the thing I was reminded of how much I love that last... I mean, you can't really call it the epilogue because, like, it's almost
it's the
like
ending.
It's the third act of the movie. Pretty much, yeah. And this movie has such a great sort of distinctive three acts, even though it is a movie of sequences, as you described. Oh, yeah. It's like very clearly three act structure too, and I love just that this AI, and it's something Spielberg is particularly gifted with, is giving you moments where it's like only cinema could give us that shot of the 2,000 years later, and I'm telling you, like, that I'm just fixated on the very long take of that shot, and you are seeing something that we will never be old enough to, if it happens, if an ice age comes in 2,000 years,
it's only the robots that survive,
right? And it, we've seen that now, and I hadn't seen it before in AI, and I love that, like, that the movie gave me that, and that's part of the thing that I think is why this movie just continues to get better, is it, like, it gets weirder as it goes, it gets darker as it goes, but it also just, like, It gives you things that cinema can do, you know, better than any other thing, you know? It reminds me of what I love about movies. That is one of those moments.
Yeah.
That ending, that sequence, just the whole thing with the advanced 2,000 years later thing.
But it's so I think strong. The reason that whole, like, artificial, like, not artificial, but, like, you know, out of this world, like, where you can't really relate to anything in there because human beings are not there, it's thousands of years in the future. The reason all of that, I think, really works is because every single section complements one another.
Right.
You have that completely, like, out of this world ending, but then you have that, like, first act where it's just like, it just feels so contemporary and so relatable. You have this family life, and there's nothing really that, like, you know, the science fiction element is, of course, the robot is the boy, but, you know, it's like, it's not full of, like, these showy special effects. It's kind of like really kind of like focused and small scale in a way. It's a
very domestic drama sort of thing going on.
And because of that, the ending really works because you're still, it's within the same movie, so you're still connected to some form of reality. So you're just like, oh, well, that's where that, you know, trajectory is going.
The Kubrick elements of this movie are the sense that, and I think that's why he's my favorite filmmaker, is every film of Stanley Kubrick's, you really feel like you've gone on a journey. Like, really, like, every story has a journey to it, like, a feel to it. You know, 2001's a great example of that. The Shining, all of those films. And this film is like that, too. I love that. Like, you really have seen a lot. Like, there's so much condensed into a 2.5-hour movie. It's very impressive in that way.
Yeah, I think
I don't know what else to add.
Like, I know
the points have been made so strongly.
But we were, but we were talking about, like, that. What happens at the ending? And getting back to that about, you know, so they create this zoo just like the end of 2001.
Right.
It's a construct. It's either a virtual construct or it's a real, like, kind of domed zoo kind of situation.
Truman Show type thing. Yeah,
yeah, and I think in order to, like, truly, just go into, like, what he is and his past and all that stuff, they need to kind of give some kind of closure to this, like, one, like, really intense goal that he has. And that's why they create that really fake-looking fairy.
Where her lips don't move?
Yeah.
Great choice. It's so creepy and unsettling, but feels right for
what... That's why, like, on the surface, if you look at it completely on the surface, it is that, like, kind of, like, schmaltzy Spielberg ending, but there's all these details that just, like...
Counter that.
Just, like, the lips not moving and the whole thing, and it's, So you get that, and I think the point that the mechas are trying to make is that they're like, okay, we'll have this artificial fairy tell him that it can't be done because you're not a real boy, and that'll be that. And then he keeps counteracting with questions about, can you bring my mommy back? Can you? And they're like, oh, we can't bring your mommy back because she's been dead for 2,000 years. We don't have her DNA. And then, boom, like that whole Teddy thing, the hair thing comes out, and they're just like, what the fuck are we going to do now? And so I think that's where that thing comes in. I think it's like this really cynical decision made by the super mecha, which at the same time, you're just like, you know, that totally makes sense. Why would you have, like, a really deep emotional connection and respect to a lab rat, basically?
They're machines.
Yeah. And so they're basically like, okay, we'll come up with this bullshit story about, like, bringing back his mother for one day.
Right.
And the beauty of that ending, the irony of that ending, is that I don't believe for a second that the mother is, it really is the clone of, that was made from that hair, because it just happens instantly.
Right.
Like, they don't, like, they're just, he basically says, like, I want you to bring my mother back, and the Super Mecha is like, all right, she's waiting in the, you know, so that's what kind of, like.
So are you saying it's probably just, like, a visual construct as a part of everything that they've created for David? Yeah, probably, right?
Because also, she doesn't ask about, like, where's my husband? Where's my son?
Right,
where's,
right.
You know, it's all, like, she's, like, so perfectly programmed
to
love him back, and the irony of that is, like, the only way you can create an artificial construct like that that can love is, and to get that love back, is if you create another artificial construct that's going to have that same the exact same kind of programmed, like.
Which is why maybe a human, the movie argues, can't fully love an artificial thing, because they're just at odds. They're actually different, right? I mean, the movie feels like it's kind of getting at that in some ways, for sure. Where can people find that article that you wrote? The, like, really extended argument and everything for it.
Oh, yeah, I'll put it on.
It is an awesome read.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's very good.
Yeah, I'll put it. I'll definitely put a link on the podcast page, and I'll just put it on there. Yeah. I mean, I just basically go through all the little sections of it, and like you said, it's like the 3-act structure of it is the family thing, the stuff with the family. I think was like a perfect first act. It even has that like fade out. Yep. That signifies, like, okay, this is the end of Act 1.
Yeah, totally.
And it's just like that, the 21 Jump Street, where it's like, it's and this is the end of Act 2. Or just, and then I think the combination of, like, the Flesh Fair and the Rouge City and then the Manhattan is, like, all second act.
Right, absolutely.
And then you have that ending that's, like, this, that just, like, ties in perfectly with that. So it almost has that, like, episodic structure, but at the same time, everything just, like, fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Thematically, but yeah, I mean, the way that I understand, like, the little nitpicky stuff, that, like, there are some little nitpicky things here and there that, of course, I understand. No film is just, like, when you go down into, like, the nitpicky little details,
I feel
like there's something in every single movie that
that's
has
why I don't really like saying anything's perfect, because there's really no such
thing. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So I can totally see all that stuff. I can see some of the, you know, maybe if you revisit it down the line a couple years later, maybe those tonal issues won't
like
bug you as well as much. I don't know, but it definitely is a film that dated, like, I feel like, extremely well, and it's going to,
I think so.
I feel like
The best science fiction does, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll post that link, and I'm also, you know, I think I'm in that, personally, I feel like I'm in that special place where just like I can, like, maybe it's like my personality that can really appreciate a weird melding of, like, Kubrick and Spielberg sensibilities.
Yeah. No, absolutely, yeah.
That I understand with some people that just, like, really doesn't work.
Right.
Because you want, like, one or the other. It's like you want the two flavors, like, to be separate in your plate.
Don't want your food to touch.
Don't want your food to touch.
It is interesting.
You're like Alan Turing. You're just, like, separating the peas and the
carrots. It is interesting that this film is much more, like, it doesn't have nearly the amount of tonal inconsistencies that something like War of the Worlds does. And this is the sort of melding of a Spielberg Kubrickian thing. You would think there would be a lot more things at odds with each other. But there are a lot more that would crop up in War of the Worlds, and he made that 4 years later. So it's strange. Like, did this movie have an effect on him because it was sort of this joint production, even though it's a Spielberg film, but you know what I mean? It's Kubrick's in there. It's impossible to deny.
You
but
feel
I
the
wonder,
pressure, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's special because it's a unique thing, and it's also a very good film. I mean, that's what's great. But yeah, it's interesting how, like, later on, like, he just, his films would get these inconsistent weird things would crop up a lot more, whereas like you would think it would happen more with this film, but it doesn't as much. So yeah, those are only minor nitpicks for me. I really think that this is a great film, and we haven't even talked about, like, the visual style that, you know, his regular DP Janusz Kaminski, like, that seeped in with a lot of the bright backlighting and the sort of smoky
that really that works, like, here and doesn't really work in War of the Worlds.
It doesn't, and there's some moments of that in War of the Worlds. It works really well in Minority Report too. Like, there's a visual style that kind of carried on where, like, you know, 3 years before AI, they did a lot of crazy shit to realize Saving Private Ryan in a different way, but they messed with, like, film exposure and, like, you know, like, frame rate speeds and stuff like that. That really went further with these science fiction dark stories that he started to get into in the 2000s. And it fits well with this.
That's
one,
true. Yeah. And an interesting thing with visually with Janusz Komiński's DP work in it, and is that interestingly, I feel like it starts off in this like kind of metallic, clinical tone.
Yes, absolutely.
And it becomes more colorful and warmer as it moves along.
And then it goes,
which is like it's juxtaposition to how many human elements and how many human right. characters you have in the film.
Right.
And it becomes like really colorful and warm at the end where you don't have any human characters.
Yeah, right.
So that's a weird, like, I don't know what you would take out of that. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the intention there? But it's almost like the same kind of like thing Kubrick did where it's the only real human character in 2001 right. is Hal.
He's so the it's only almost three-dimensional yeah. character really yeah
it's
yeah.
almost like a visual way of like kind of saying like, yeah, these machines might be our future, and they're mm-hmm. you know, in some ways they might be like more human than the human character. So you have that opening scene where it's like it's all human characters right. in this, like, the CEO office or, like, the meeting office or whatever. And it's just, like, looks really metallic.
Yeah.
And then the ending looks really colorful and warm. So, that's, you know, that's there are many, many different layers in there that just, like, really, that really work for me. But, yeah, I feel like this is definitely, AI is definitely one that, like, if you were kind of put off by it at first, you know, if the only time you watched it was, like, when it first came out, I feel like if you give it a chance now, you'll find out that it has, like, dated like really, really well.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if someone didn't think it was at least a more interesting movie than they remember it if they saw it at the time.
Yeah.
And if people thought it's not worth it, I think it is worth your time for sure to check this
absolutely.
One out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
To revisit it again. Cool. All right. So should we call it quits?
Let's wrap it up.
All right. Do you want to do the outro?
Sure. Signing off is Ryan Oliver, host of the Gotcha Movies podcast and associate editor at gotchamovies.com.
It sounded like you forgot your name though. What the fuck is my name again? This is Octavia Kozak. I'm on the internet. I'm a film critic for The Playlist, Oregon Herald, DVD Talk, and diaspora.com.
Eric McClanahan signing off here. My other podcast is Adjust Your Tracking, film editor for Oregon Arts Watch, and features writer for The Playlist.
All right, we'll be back soon with another overrated and underrated pick.